tanks, they sprayed creamy yellow foam over each of the downed human forms. Beneath their mounds of foam, the still living and the newly dead dissolved, liquefying into sheets of bubbling brown goo that poured off the edges of the sidewalk and into the asphalt sand. Grubb heard a hissing sound quite close and felt a sudden warm wetness between the toes of his bare feet. When he looked down, heart thudding, he saw that he was standing in a quickly spreading puddle of urine that wasn't his own. The gaudy woman beside him began to wail at the top of her lungs. He grabbed her by the arm and jerked her away from the window.
For Nuke's sake, shut your face! You want to put them muty bastards on us?
But the poor woman was wild-eyed with fear. If anything, her cries got louder. Grubb took hold of her face, squeezing her jaws shut, and gave a hard shove that sent her stumbling backward onto the mattress. As she scrambled to take cover beneath it, he pulled on his torn desert camouflage BDUs and raggedy jungle boots.
Good thinking. They sure as shit won't find you there.
Realizing she was in no position to complain, Grubb picked up the Roadmaster hubcap on his way out the door. The sun's sweltering heat made the empty eye socket beneath Ryan Cotter's black patch itch. He shut his one good eye and listened. Hard. Crouched in the shade of the stand of scraggy mutant willow trees, the tall, powerfully built man blocked out the sawing hum of insects, the steady plip-plop-plip of his own sweat dripping into the sand, and the footfalls of his companions approaching around the bend in the river channel. Though Ryan strained to pick up sounds of pursuit, he could hear nothing. Out of sight and earshot, faceless, nameless hunters dogged Ryan and his friends across the floodplain of the dried-up river. More than a mile wide, its thousands of narrow willow islands were separated by winding sandy lanes, which, during the wet season, were interlaced stream braids. It was an evil place, a maze of nearly identical paths bordered by skinny trees 10 feet tall, their lower branches creeping along the ground like vines. The area was full of patches of quicksand, rad-blasted suffocating heat, and dark-scummed puddles of poisoned water, a place made to order for ambush by both four-legged and two-legged predators. And Ryan and his companions were moving through this no-man's land at a snail's pace, when they were moving at all. The sound of a baby fussing cut through the throbbing insect song. Someone made soft shushing noises as the scrape of boot soles on sand grew louder. Ryan opened his eye, and leaning on the stock of his Steyr SSG-70 sniper rifle, looked over at J.B. Dix, who knelt in a patch of shade on the other side of the wash, his fedora tipped back on his head. Rivulets of perspiration poured around the wire frames of J.B.'s glasses and down the sides of his face. He held a Smith & Wesson M4000 shotgun balanced between pistol grip and pump slide, index finger braced against the outside of the trigger guard, poised and ready for anything. The two men had traveled Deathlands together for many years. Both had been in the service of the legendary traitor, J.B. as his armorer, Ryan as his second in command. In the traitor's employ, and in the years after, they had survived more pitched battles than either could begin to count. Long ago, words between them had become unnecessary. J.B. looked back toward the source of the mewling cries and shook his head. For what had to have been the dozenth time in their two-hour trek, the two men had had to stop and wait for the main file to catch up to them. Another full minute passed before a tall, skinny man dressed in a dusty frock coat and tall boots rounded the bend in the stream. He carried an ebony walking stick with a silver lion's head for a handle. The cane concealed a steel serpent's tongue, a wicked, double-edged short sword. Though he appeared to be in his mid-60s, Ryan knew that chronologically Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner was close to 250 years old. He had been born in the small village of South Stratford, Vermont, in the year 1868. 130 years later, the first successful experiment in time trawling, codenamed Operation Kronos, had plucked him without his consent from his wife and children, from a simpler, if not kinder and gentler world, and had deposited him in a top-secret government laboratory. Because of the physiological and psychological shock brought on by the experience, the Oxford Doctor of Philosophy had proved a less-than-ideal test subject. His truculence had caused the Operation Kronos researchers considerable frustration and aggravation. In the year 2000, just before Skydark, the scientists decided Doc was more trouble than he was worth and sent him forward in time to Deathlands. Seeing that Ryan and JB had stopped, Doc slid a massive black powder revolver from the front of his frock coat. The gold-engraved Lama was a relic of the decade of Tanner's birth. Arguably the Civil War's most potent sidearm, the Lama fired 9.44-caliber balls through a 6.5-inch top barrel. A second, shorter barrel beneath the first had a much bigger bore, chambered for a single scattergun round. The blue Whistler barrel was currently packed with a mixture of glass and iron fragments. Capable of inflicting devastating damage in close-quarters combat, this particular payload gave new meaning to the phrase facelift. Doc hand-signaled those walking behind him to slow down and be careful. Christy Roth appeared around the bend, her glorious mane of prehensile red hair cascading around her shoulders, the centers of her cheeks rosy from the riverbed's raging heat. She had tied the arms of her long, shaggy black fur coat around her waist. In one hand, she held a .38-caliber Smith & Wesson Model 640 revolver. The other hand shielded a girl child of about 7, who stood timidly behind her long legs. The girl wore a faded and tattered dress, and her blonde hair was hacked off in a bowl shape just below the ears. Christie's emerald green eyes sought out and locked onto Ryan's face. As with JB, there was a connection between them, a different sort of connection to be sure, but one that also didn't require words. Though Ryan felt something akin to tenderness at the sight of his woman so fiercely protecting the child, his face gave nothing away. Wrong time, wrong place. Reading her lover's expression, Christy lowered the blaster, but didn't reholster it as she advanced. A second or two later, Dr. Mildred Wyeth stepped into view. The stocky black woman was also a time traveler of sorts, cryogenically frozen after a life-threatening reaction to anesthetic on December 28, 2000, the medical doctor had been reanimated by Ryan and his companions after a century of near-death sleep. Her hair in beaded plaits, Mildred wore baggy desert camo BDU pants, and her gray sleeveless T-shirt was soaked through with sweat, front and back. On her right hip, arms locked around her neck, legs gripping her waist, rode another girl child. This one was frail and about 6 years old. Mildred carried her Czech-built ZKR-551 hand blaster with its muzzle pointed skyward. She was a deadly accurate markswoman. Lifetimes ago, when such things still had meaning, she had won a silver medal in the last ever Olympic Games. Right behind Mildred was the source of all the racket, an infant in the arms of a young mother. The woman wore a shapeless dress made of sewn-together scraps of colored cloth. A broad-brimmed, crudely woven straw hat shielded both mother and child from the sun. Abruptly, the insect song stopped, and the baby momentarily ceased its fussing. In the sudden, oppressive silence, Ryan could hear the rasp of his own breathing. He didn't have to explain to his companions what was wrong. Sweaty hands tightened on pistol grips as they searched the tree lines for the slightest flicker of movement. Something was closing in on them from all sides, homing in on the baby's cries. The woman called Uda moved the weight of her infant to her other arm.
Why are we stopping again?
Not wanting to panic the young mother and the older children, and therefore compound their predicament, Ryan told her only part of the truth.
We're going too slow. We gotta pick up the pace. We'll wait here a couple of minutes and let Jack and your man Benji catch up. Then we'll shift the loads around. The men will carry the girls from here on. And after that, there'll be no more stops. Everybody double times it until we're out of this hell pit.
The woman nodded. All she wanted was to get her family to someplace safe, and as quickly as possible. Ryan looked away from her worried but hopeful face. He knew the chances were she wasn't going to make it. Maybe none of them would make it. He looked over at his son Dean, nearly 12 years old and almost the mirror image of himself, and understood her concern. Uda and Benji had been driven from their hardscrabble farm by an outbreak of the bloody flux in nearby Brighamville. They had abandoned everything they owned in their haste to escape the spreading contagion. Ryan and the companions had learned about the cholera epidemic from some travelers on the road and accordingly had given the Ville an extra wide berth. On the edge of the desolate floodplain that separated Brigham from the nearest disease-free Ville, they had come across the refugee family. Despite Ryan's warnings,